The briefing is brought to you in association with the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai is a place for city leaders, developers, architects and designers to come together and innovate for the future of urban spaces. It's an opportunity for the Global South to convene in the Global South. It's a testbed for real-world solutions that will shape the future of people and planet. You can hear from the innovative thinkers and inspirational voices that drove the narrative at this year's edition by listening to Monocle's special episodes of The Briefing, recorded live at Expo City Dubai in March. Find and listen to the shows now at monocle.com or wherever you get your podcasts. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024. Collaborate, innovate, transform.
You are listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 18th of October 2021 on Monocle 24. The Briefing is brought to you in association with Novartis. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I am Markus Hippi. Coming up, the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson leads tributes to the MP Sir David Amos, who was killed in his constituency on Friday.
David was a man who believed passionately in this country and in its future. And we've lost today a fine public servant and a much-loved friend and colleague.
We'll ask what Sir David's death will mean for the safety of the UK's politicians as they go about their daily business. Also ahead, we find out why Virginia's governor race could be a bellwether test for next year's US midterms.
I'm running against a candidate who actually has been spreading anti-vax rhetoric throughout the Commonwealth of Virginia. We cannot move this economy forward and keep our schools open if we're not getting our folks vaccinated.
Plus an update on Kosovo and the latest as a Russian film crew returns to Earth following a short stint on the International Space Station. All that's right here on The Briefing with me, Markus Hippi. The British Prime Minister Boris Johnson will lead tributes to Sir David Amos in the House of Commons today as Parliament discusses how to step up security in the wake of the MP's killing. Sir David's death on Friday has sent shockwaves through British politics, just as the murder of another parliamentarian, Joe Cox, did 5 years ago. I'm joined now by regular Monocle 24 contributor Lance Price. Lance is heavily involved in the Joe Cox Foundation, which was set up in her memory and now serves as Chief of Staff to the MP Kim Leadbeater, who is Ms. Cox's sister. Lance, welcome to the programme. Could you first start by describing the reaction in Westminster to Sir David's death?
I think everyone has been deeply shocked, not just because Sir David was a very well-known figure around Westminster. He'd been an MP for well over 30 years and was genuinely much liked. I mean, we all have our political differences in politics, but David was a guy that almost everybody seemed to be able to get on with, and he had a very sort of positive outlook on life and usually had a smile on his face and a cheery welcome. So people are genuinely sad, obviously, at what has happened, but they're also very reflective. And they are thinking back to the murder of Joe Cox in 2016. Joe was a good friend of mine. I knew David Amos as well. These people were human beings. They had a job in politics that exposed them to risk, and they recognised that. But I think all the other MPs who will be gathering later today to pay their tributes will have in the back of their minds that, let's be honest, it could have been them. Mm.
The MP, Kim Leadbeater, who you work for, has said that her partner wants her to stand down. What can you tell us?
Well, the decision that Kim took earlier this year to put herself forward for Joe's old seat in Battling Spen was a very, very difficult one. And she discussed it with her partner, she discussed it with her parents and her friends and those of us who are close to the family. And she decided that it was the right thing to do, that probably, although who could ever answer that question, but it's probably what Jo herself would have wanted. But we were all very conscious at that time that security would be a major consideration. And it has to be said that the West Yorkshire Police, Batley and Spens in West Yorkshire in the north of England, the West Yorkshire Police have been fantastic in protecting Kim and her family throughout all of this. But you can just imagine how this felt for Kim herself, but also for her partner, for her parents, to hear that another MP had been killed in such similar circumstances, stabbed at a constituency event on a Friday. And it's, you know, it isn't a big surprise that that she should have said what she did. And Kim has had to reflect on that.
What do you think she's been thinking? Do you think she would consider leaving politics?
No, I don't think she will. I think she takes the view that you need good people in politics. You need the right people in politics who go into it for the right reasons. And the vast majority of MPs do exactly that. But there's also a sense that you don't let the terrorists win. They want to drive good people out of politics. They want to create division. They want to set communities against each other. That's the very purpose of their atrocious acts that they form. One response to that, not the only response, but one response to that is to ensure that democracy carries on, that it is resilient, and that, you know, brave people continue to do brave things. And I'm afraid that includes Kim and the decision that she has taken, that she's going to carry on representing the people of Batley and Spens to the best of her ability, but she's also going to spend as much time as is required to make sure that she is safe and that her family and loved ones know that she's safe.
Exactly, Lance. What kind of discussion is taking place in Westminster now when it comes to the MPs and their safety? Obviously, constituent surgeries, for example, are a very important part of the MPs' work.
They are. They've changed already. I mean, they changed during lockdown, of course, because it wasn't possible to meet people face-to-face. And a lot of that constituency work has now happened, or has been happening virtually, through the internet and through Zoom and all the rest of it. The days when you could have constituency surgeries that were advertised all around town and anybody could come along without an appointment, just turn up and see their MP, those days have gone, and they're never, ever going to come back. And it's a shame, but it's a fact of life, and that's where we find ourselves, which does mean that I think most MPs, if not all MPs now, will insist on people making an appointment to see them. There'll be more security around the locations where those meetings happen. They may not be advertised in advance, other than to those people who have been invited to come along. There may be an increased amount of physical security, but the British parliamentary system of representative democracy, it's not unique in the world, but it is one of those which offers the highest levels of personal contact between constituents and their representatives. And I think the sense I get from talking to a lot of MPs of all parties is that they want to retain as much of that as they possibly can.
Now, what do you think? How much can or should be done to step up security in these regular events?
I think it has to be regularised. I mean, in Kim's case, as you said in your introduction, I now work for Kim Leadbeater, whose sister was murdered, and as a result of that, we have gone through very, very rigorous security precautions. It wouldn't be appropriate to discuss all of those on the radio for obvious reasons, but some MPs are protected better than others. And now that may be because of the jobs they hold. Certainly government ministers, the more sensitive government ministers, have a very high level of protection and rarely come into direct physical contact with people without police officers and often armed police officers at their side. Then there are people who are deemed to be at significant risk or where there's significant concern. And my MP, Kim Leadbeater, would be one of those because of what happened previously in her constituency to her sister. But that's not the case for all MPs. And it may be that many of those MPs who've sort of, let's be honest, they've sort of shrugged and said, well, look, I'm just prepared to take the risk. I don't feel particularly at risk. and I'm going to carry on as normal. I think they may have to get used to a much higher level of security. There's an imbalance. The truth is that in terms of threats and intimidation and online threats, women get it much more than men do. MPs from ethnic minorities get it far more than white MPs do, and they're more used to it, and perhaps they're more used to taking precautions. And I think perhaps in some areas of the House of Commons there's been a degree of complacency that it couldn't happen to them. Well, it has happened to one of them, and possibly to one of those people who didn't feel that they were at risk, and now we know that they all are.
Thank you very much for your thoughts, Lance. That was Lance Price. And now here is Monocle's Emma Searle with the day's other news headlines.
Thanks, Marcus. France's ambassador to Belarus has left the country following an order from officials in Minsk. Nicolas de Lacoste has reportedly failed to present his credentials to President Alexander Lukashenko. France, like other European Union countries, has not recognized Lukashenko's claim to a sixth presidential term. New data suggests China's economy has grown at its slowest pace in a year. Analysts say that power shortages, supply chain bottlenecks, and major wobbles in the property market are to blame for the latest quarterly results. It raises pressure on policymakers to do more to prop up China's economy. Italy's coronavirus passport has become mandatory in all of the country's workplaces. The Green Pass has proved widely popular in the country, but its introduction has prompted protests from some of Italy's remaining 3.8 million unvaccinated workers. For more, head to monocle.com/minute. And a Russian film crew has returned to Earth after spending 12 days on the International Space Station. The pair were brought back safely by the cosmonaut Oleg Novitsky, who had been on the space station for the past 6 months. We'll have more on the story a little later on today's programme. Those are the day's headlines. Back to you, Marcus.
Thanks very much, Emma. The former US President Barack Obama is hitting the campaign trail in Virginia this week in an attempt to boost support for the Democrats in a closely fought governor's election. The outcome of next month's ballot is being seen as a bellwether for the 2022 US midterms. Let's get the latest now with the political commentator Linda Chavez. Linda is a former advisor to Ronald Reagan and joins me on the line from Maryland. Welcome to the program. Could you first tell us why Virginia matters so much? Why is it so crucial for the Democrats that they win there?
Well, first of all, it is an off-year election. It's one of the few statewide elections that are held in a year between normal federal elections. So there's a lot of tension on it. But more importantly, Virginia, which was once solidly in the Republican fold, really changed over the last decade or so and has become more solidly blue. So if there is a flip this year and Terry McAuliffe, who is the Democrat, does not win election and the Republican does, I think it will bode very poorly for the Democrats' chances in next year's midterm elections and in the 2024 presidential election.
Now, why is it then former U.S. President Barack Obama who is going to Virginia and not, for example, President Biden himself?
Well, I think President Biden will be making an appearance as well. But the point of Barack Obama's coming into Virginia is mostly to try to energize the African-American vote. This is a very large portion of the state vote and an even larger portion of the Democratic vote in the state. And there is some concern that because it's an off-year election, that there will be some complacency. Blacks in Virginia and elsewhere are also sort of worn out from many, you know, protests over the after the death of George Floyd. There obviously were very energized in last year's presidential election. And so there's some concerns that they simply may not turn out to the polls in the numbers necessary for Terry McAuliffe to win.
Now, what exactly do you expect from Obama? What will he do in Virginia?
I think what he's going to do is try to speak directly to the African-American vote and to try to make sure that those voters understand what the stakes are, how high the stakes are, not just for the state of Virginia, but for the nation as a whole. So I think his point is to try to get out the vote, to try to ensure that people do show up to the polls on Election Day. And there's nobody better at doing that. Just in general, he's a terrific speaker, and he's very well regarded by his party, but particularly in the African-American community, because he was, after all, the first and so far our only African-American president.
Exactly. Now, what are the Republicans doing at the same time?
Well, Glenn Youngkin is having to walk a very fine line. He is a businessman, has not been particularly involved in politics before venturing into the run for the governorship. He was early endorsed by Donald Trump. In fact, he's been endorsed, I think, half a dozen times by Donald Trump. And he needs that endorsement because he needs, just as Barack Obama can motivate the African-American vote, so can Donald Trump motivate the rural white vote. And so Youngkin needs those voters. On the other hand, in order to win, he also needs suburban voters in the counties surrounding Washington, D.C. And those voters are very turned off by Donald Trump. So Youngkin has not an easy path either. He has to not alienate the former president's supporters. At the same time, he has to try to woo back some of those voters in the suburbs who traditionally were more likely to vote for Republicans, but who were so anti-Trump that they basically did not vote for the former president in the last election. And the hope is, on Youngkin's part, that they won't be so turned off that they won't vote for him either.
Now, ahead of next month's ballot, what do you think, what have been the most significant or most interesting election pledges we've been hearing from these candidates so far?
Well, I think one of the most, I mean, there have been more problems, I think, than there have been interesting election pledges. I think Terry McAuliffe, who was doing pretty comfortably well, sort of stepped on his own message when in a debate he uttered what is unforgivable in much of the United States, which is that parents should not have the right to decide what teachers are going to teach. And I think he's tried to walk back that sentiment. He was reacting to controversy over the controversial critical race theory debate that is taking place in many school districts across the country. But that hurt him a great deal. And so that's one of his challenges.
That was Linda Chavez there, the US political commentator. Thank you very much for joining us here on The Briefing.
Novartis is proud to partner The Briefing on Monocle 24. Novartis is a company that is committed to reimagining medicine. The global healthcare leader intent on changing the practice of medicine, Novartis has been exploring uncharted frontiers in science for more than a century. Today, the company is working on breakthrough treatments that push the boundaries of human understanding in biology, data science, and engineering to develop and deliver therapies that help people live longer and healthier lives around the world. Novartis, reimagining medicine.
You are back with a briefing on Monocle 24. I am Markus Hippi. We head to Kosovo now, which has been contesting municipal elections. Voting there has attracted considerable attention following a deterioration in the often fraught relationship between Kosovo and Serbia. Monocle's correspondent in the Balkans, Gajda Loni, joins me now for the latest. Good afternoon to you, Guy. Shall we start by looking at what's been happening so far? Who's looking like they've done well from this election?
The governing party, Vatoven Dosje, has taken a little bit, I think a kicking might be saying, put it taking it too far, but it certainly hasn't enjoyed the kind of results that it would have liked to have done. So Vatoven Dosje, which is the party of Prime Minister Albin Kurti, hasn't won any of the municipalities or the mayoral elections so far. It's still involved in quite a number of races which are going into a second round, including the one in the capital, Pristina. But it's the older, longer established parties which are already celebrating having won some of those municipal elections, these parties which were generally linked to the Kosovo Liberation Army, which were resoundingly seen off by Vetevendosia in national elections just last year. So there's definitely been a little bit of a switch in the power dynamic just in the space of 8 months.
What does all this say about the state of play in Kosovo?
Well, I think people were looking for Vetevendosia to do something different to what they've actually done. Now, you alluded at the start to these tensions with Serbia, and Vetevendosia in recent weeks has been really ramping it up. In fact, it's been ramping it up ever since they got into power. They've decided that the strategy they're going to have towards Serbia is going to be a very aggressive one, both in word and increasingly in deed. So we saw last week that the Kosovo Special Police once again involved in confrontations, violent confrontations with members of ethnic Serb communities in northern Kosovo, that time over some police raids on a smuggling operation. They were saying it's a legitimate police operation. We weren't trying to antagonize people in the north of the country. Serbia, very unimpressed by what was going on. Prior to that, we had quite a long standoff over the issue of Kosovo delegitimizing Serbian number plates, which were used by tens of thousands of ethnic Serbs in Kosovo. And again, you had a standoff there, some violence between the special police and members of the ethnic Serb community. That isn't really what voters voted for Vetevendosia in order to see. They wanted to see Vetevendosia bring an end to the corruption and kleptocracy in Kosovo. They didn't really want it to get involved in these sort of shenanigans with Serbia, but they've probably misunderstood the character of the party. It is fundamentally a hardline Albanian nationalist party, and they are just doing what, frankly, I would have expected them to do in the first place, but voters have been very disappointed.
Can you tell us more about that? Indeed, as you mentioned, there's been recent tensions with ethnic Serbs in Kosovo, police and protesters clashing once again in northern Kosovo last week, for example. How much and how has that played into elections?
Well, I think a lot of people were looking at it and saying, well, maybe Vetevendosia is ramping up this tension to try and appeal to people, to try and show that they're going to be strong. They're not going to let Serbia or the government in Belgrade push them around. But I think when you have really appealed to voters and the voters have voted for you on the grounds that they see you as a new hope, a fresh party that's going to do something different after the disappointments of the governments that have been in power since the unilateral declaration of independence in 2008, then you're probably barking up the wrong tree. They really wanted to see what you were going to do about corruption, improving infrastructure in the country, and about taking the country forward so that people would want to stay rather than leaving in their tens of thousands, as they've been doing every year, particularly young people. And those young people are the ones who voted for Vetevendosia in the main. They're perhaps the ones who stayed away from the polls on Sunday.
Mm. Now, some analysts were getting worried about the possibility of an actual conflict between Kosovo and Serbia. What do you think about that? Is there any prospect for that?
I always think it's pretty unlikely. People tend to get very excited by the war of words that goes on between Belgrade and Pristina. And they get very excited, of course, when President Vucic of Serbia will say something like, well, if NATO's KFOR peacekeepers don't intervene in 24 hours, we'll have to intervene. And the mobilising of troops on the border between Serbia and Kosovo, it seems very threatening. But it's part of a little play that we see being acted out every now and again between Belgrade and Pristina. But what I always say is there's always the potential for accidents to happen. The wrong person does the wrong thing at the wrong time, and before you know it, things are escalating. And I think that's why the international community, whether that's the United States, the European Union, or NATO's KFOR peacekeepers, always said these times for everybody to stay calm and try and back off from these positions of tension. Because while I think nobody's aim is to provoke a conflict, you can still have things go awry.
And just finally, Guy, indeed, the early results in Kosovo's municipal election, we have got them. When we get the final results in a bit longer term, how much do you think will actually change in Kosovo as a result of this election?
Well, I think the big one that we're waiting for, really, is what's going to happen in the capital, Pristina. If Vetevan Dossier may maintain control there, they can still use that as their model project to show what they can do in Kosovo. Not all of this nationalist saber-rattling that I think has been very unpopular with voters, but rather the improvements to the capital city and thereby potentially to the country that voters really wanted.
Guy, thank you very much for your insights. That was Monaco's correspondent in the Balkans, Guy Delaunay, and you're listening to The Briefing. And finally today, a Russian film crew has returned to Earth after spending 12 days on the International Space Station. The pair were shooting scenes for the first movie in orbit. Let's get the latest now with the space scientist and author Dr. David Whitehouse. Thanks for joining us as always, David. How much more can you tell us about this production? How impressed are you, first of all?
Well, it is the first movie set in space. I mean, we've all seen science fiction films set on space stations, set in space, and they are very good. But this is the real thing. We did not know much about the plot of this movie, but when they set off. But from the activity on board the space station, it seems that somehow it involves the current astronaut, who's a professional astronaut there, who had some sort of medical problem in the plot and was unable to return to Earth for treatment. And this female doctor, Yulia Pereslid, goes up in order to treat him. And so it's an adventure story in that respect. The filming evidently went well, and we shall wait and see what the timescale for the release of the film is.
Exactly. Let's talk about practicalities when it comes to filming in space. I'm wondering, first of all, how much space is there on the International Space Station to all of a sudden get over a crew filming a film, shooting a film?
Well, there's not much space, if you like, from side to side. It's like being in a living room. It's, you know, it's a couple of metres, it's 3 or 4 metres across. But what you can do very effectively, and you can go online and see films which have already been shot like this, is fly through it. You can fly along the modules, come to the nodes and go right and left, and then go into the storage modules, the habitat modules. You can go up to the cupola, which I'm sure they will have used, which is a panoramic window, which gives you spectacular views. So although, you know, you in any one place, the movement is limited. Actually, you could be very creative in moving around the space station, and turning corners and chasing people and, well, you know, that type of thing. So filmed properly, and it does seem they did spend over 20 hours filming there, then this could be, you know, quite spectacular. And let's see what the plot is.
What about those staff members who actually work on the ISS for a bit longer? Did they get any other work done? What do you reckon? Okay. What kind of distraction was this film?
I don't think it bothered them too much, actually. I mean, I know that Russia was very for this. The head of the Russian Space Agency really wanted to do this, even though many cosmonauts were a bit worried about this. He pushed it and got it done. America was a little bit sniffy about this. But then again, when word emerged that SpaceX, Elon Musk's company, was in negotiation with Tom Cruise's film company and the possibility of Tom Cruise going to the space station sometime next year, perhaps, then, of course, all the objections tended to fade away because Russia actually got in there first. I think that was their intention, to make the first film in space, knowing that next year or the year after, I don't know whether it were a Mission Impossible series of films or just a standalone, that America would do the same. So they're feeling pretty proud of themselves and smug at the moment, having done it first.
Do you have any idea how expensive it might have been to spend 12 days filming at the station?
Well, the cost of the launch and the support is going to be something of the order of £15 million, something of the order of $20 million. Now, that is the cost if you actually went to the Russian Space Agency and say, can I buy a seat? And you'd be trained, you'd wait your turn and pay your money. But I rather think that this was done, you know, much cheaper than that, in the sense that the seat was given to the film crew. They did not have to pay. So if you were making a film and you had to bear the cost of that, bear $20 million, and recoup it in the box office, then perhaps this might not have been done. This is a lost leader, if you like. This is to promote the Russian Space Agency at a time when they are losing money, they're losing political support, and they see China emerging as a stronger space power. They see the United States wanting to go back to the moon. So this is part of, if you like, a fight back, and I'm sure they'll consider it money well spent.
Now, just finally, David, considering that you are indeed a space scientist, I have to ask this question. There's been quite a lot of space-related news recently. For example, William Shatner had his own space trip. Are you into this idea? Would you like to go to space?
You know, I would like to go into space. I'm sure it would be absolutely fascinating. But it's very expensive at the moment. And I'm sure I'm like most people in the sense that, you know, if you had to, you know, wanted to pay £250,000 to go with Virgin Galactic or more to go with Jeff Bezos. At the moment, I can think of a lot better things I'd use the money on. So once it gets to be a reasonable price, and who knows when that will be, I think it'd be at least 10 years. Yeah, I would be particularly interested, but it's a curiosity in my mind that I've spent my life in space business and astronomy. And to be honest, it would be fun, but I'm not desperate to go.
Fair enough. Space scientist and author David Whitehouse there. Thank you very much. And that's all for this edition of The Briefing. It was produced by Rhys James and Emma Searle. Our researcher was Sophie Monahan-Coombs and our studio manager was Christy Evans. The Briefing is back tomorrow at the same time. I am Markus Hippi. Goodbye and thanks for listening.